Coming up on the FSR Sarcfighter podcast, Kinevant Sciences is making progress on a drug to fight sarcoidosis.
First, it provides us statistically with the best chances of demonstrating that the drug that we are developing has a treatment benefit for patients.
In this episode of the FSR Sarcfighter podcast, an exciting update on namilumab from Kinevant CEO Bill Gearhart and patient advocate Rainey Rogers.
And it says a lot about just the lack of previous research, and it also is a really exciting beacon of light and hope for the future.
This is the Sarcfighter Podcast, living with sarcoidosis and other rare diseases. Here's your host, John Carlin.
Well, hello, this is episode 113 of the FSR Sarcfighter Podcast. I'm your host, John Carlin. I, of course, do this podcast to help you understand what's going on with you and help give you a sense of hope as you deal with this unpredictable disease. There's always something new around every corner. They call sarcoidosis the snowflake disease because it's different for everybody, and in every case, it can impact just about any part of your being. And I say that because it's both physically and mentally a problem for so many people, and it can show up in just about any organ, and where it does and how much it does just makes every single person's case different. And just a lot of people with sarcoidosis, I don't want to use the word bewildered, but you're always wondering, you know, what's next? What's going to happen with me and with sarcoidosis? And what have I gotten myself into? And we try to answer those questions as best we can here on the FSR Sarcfighter podcast. And I say we because it's me sitting here in my little audio studio in my office. But it's the folks at FSR, it is you, the patients, it is the pharmaceutical community like we have today. And, I just like to think of this podcast as the voice of sarcoidosis. And today I am pleased to report that there is a great deal of hope, and we'll talk about it in today's episode. It's a return appearance of Bill Gearhart and Rainey Rogers from Kinevant Sciences, a company that is developing a drug to fight sarcoidosis. Their drug, namilumab, has cleared another hurdle in its progress toward hopefully becoming a new arrow in the quiver for medical science to use in the fight against sarcoidosis. A little bit of history. Bill and Rainey were on the show way back in August of 2022, and it is now early May of 2024, so almost 2 years ago. And since then, namilumab has been going through the clinical trial process, trying to make sure that it's safe and effective. And today, the Kinevant folks are here to report to us just how far things have progressed, and I can tell you that it is all positive so far. Now, essentially, they've completed enrollment in phase two of their clinical trial, which even if you're a big pharma company with all the millions of dollars backing a trial, you still can't always convince people to enroll in these clinical trials. And so oftentimes, whether it's sarcoidosis or anything else, the trials can falter and a drug may not progress to its full promise. And folks have told me that it is difficult to get, in particular, sarcoidosis patients to enroll in clinical trials. There's so few of us, so scattered. I mean, it's just not easy. Okay, but they've completed enrollment now in phase two, and that is a big reason to stand up and shout. All right, now let's just quickly review. If you remember, there are several phases to clinical trials. Phase one trials essentially test if a new treatment is safe, and they begin to look at the best way to give the treatment, and doctors will look for some signs that sarcoidosis responds to the new treatment. That's phase one. Phase two trials test to see if, in fact, sarcoidosis responds to that new treatment. And then phase three trials test if the new treatment is better than the standard treatment, Okay. And we're not at phase three yet. And in order to do these trials, of course, patients have to sign up to participate and they agree to regular checkups more often than what would maybe be their normal checkups because doctors want to monitor the progress, right? And also, if something goes off the rails, you know, they want to know that too. Typically, some patients get the drug being tested. Some get the placebo, a sugar pill, if you will. And in a blind test, the patients don't know which one they receive, but the doctors do. And then at the end, they check to see if those who got the drug did better than those who didn't. And that's where they are. So now we are in the enrollment phase, the completed enrollment phase with Kinevant. And Bill and Rainey are here to report on the progress. And they are going to take a much deeper dive into it as we go through our discussion. And I think you will be pleased to hear what they have to say. And Bill in particular is very good at digging into talking about these proteins and what it is that makes a drug do what it does, how it reacts with different things that are happening within the body, and doing that in a way that all of us can understand. And I know that is appreciated. So we'll get to Bill and to Rainey here in just a second. Just very quickly, I hope you're enjoying the Sark Fighter podcast. I want to ask you to help me reach more people so FSR can be as effective as possible by distributing the messaging here in the podcast. So it helps me reach more people if you would subscribe, of course, give it a 5-star review, give it a nice verbal or text review wherever you get your podcast, and then share it on your social media. It really does help. And if you've got a network of people where you can get them to listen to it, it just does really help. And so I appreciate that, and it makes all the effort that all of us put into the podcast, it just makes it more worthwhile when we know it's reaching more people and is therefore ipso facto more effective. Okay, thank you so much for that. So it's time to get to Kinevant, Bill and Rainey, coming up here on the FSR Sark Fighter podcast. Hi, I hope you're enjoying the Sark Fighter podcast. You may be wondering, what can I do to help? How can I be a part of the sarcoidosis solution? It's simple. Make a donation to KISS, Kick In to Stop Sarcoidosis. 100% of the money goes to the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research. Look for a link in the show notes of the Sark Fighter podcast. Welcome back to the FSR Sark Fighter podcast. I'm joined today by Bill Gearhart, who is the CEO of Kinevant, and Rainey Rogers, who is the Senior Director of Patient Advocacy. And we are going to talk about an exciting new development in terms of the evolution of a potential drug to fight sarcoidosis. That drug is called namilumab. Bill, Rainey, thank you so much for joining me here on the podcast today.
Grateful for the opportunity to provide you with an update and to just generally talk about developing new therapies for those living with sarcoidosis.
Outstanding. Rainey, thank you for joining me as well.
Thanks so much for having us, John. Always good to see you and get caught up on all things happening for the sarcoidosis community.
Well, this is very exciting. So where we are right now, the last time you guys were on, it seems like it was yesterday, but it was in August of 2022. I'll put a link in the show notes if people want to go back and listen to that. But this is a big, important update because Kinevant has now completed enrollment in the phase two of the clinical trial for namilumab. So, Bill, what is the significance of that?
Yeah, sure, John. Thank you. As a reminder, we initiated a clinical trial, a phase two clinical trial that we call Resolve Lung. And middle of 2022, and we have been working really hard to enroll that study over the last year and a half, and we're excited and pleased to announce that we've completed enrollment in that study, which is important because first, it provides us statistically with the best chances of demonstrating that the drug that we are developing has a treatment benefit for patients. And also, I think it's just important for the field to demonstrate the feasibility of conducting clinical research in sarcoidosis. There have been only a few trials in pulmonary sarcoidosis in the past, and in some cases, those trials were terminated early because they weren't able to enroll them. And in other cases, they weren't able to completely enroll those studies, which adversely impacts the potential for showing the drug works. So completing enrollment in a pulmonary sarcoidosis study is a big accomplishment, which is why we're doing some hand waving today. And it also gives us the best chance to demonstrate the treatment benefit of the drug, which we're hopeful will be very positive, and we expect to be able to report those top line results out by the end of this year.
Okay, so the end of 2024.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so it did take it took a little longer than you had hoped to get to your full enrollment, did it not?
It did. You know, rare diseases in general are a challenging. Important but challenging disease area to conduct clinical research. First of all, there aren't a lot of patients. And second of all, there aren't a lot of clinical centers, medical centers, where you can conduct clinical research for a rare disease. Sarcoidosis is no different. It's also challenging because there just isn't a lot of history of clinical trials that have been done. So there are a lot of clinicians who treat sarcoidosis patients who have never participated in a clinical trial. There are a lot of patients who have never participated in a clinical trial. And so it was new and a bit of a learning experience. And it took a while for people to understand and to be comfortable participating in clinical research. And there's a large segment of pulmonary sarcoidosis patients that are hesitant to participate in clinical trials. There's sort of an unwillingness to take a little bit of risk or a little bit of inconvenience to participate. And that's, eventually needs to be overcome, because one of the reasons why patients don't have better therapies for treating this disease is because of patients historically unwilling to participate in clinical trials. And if they're unwilling to participate in clinical trials, new therapies cannot be developed for patients that are more effective or more well tolerated, and hopefully ultimately leads to a cure. We always like to talk to clinicians and to patients about the role of clinical trials and the, of course, risks, so that everybody's fully informed, but also the benefit to not just them, but to current and successive generations of patients who have this disease. Gotcha. There's also a large percentage of patients who have sarcoidosis who are hesitant for historical reasons. There's a mistrust of pharmaceutical companies and of institutions in general. For good reason. And I think that regaining the trust of all patients with sarcoidosis through transparency, through education, through communication, relationship development is really key to being able to more successfully enable clinical research in the future.
Well, hopefully you've bridged the gap, or all of us collectively are bridging the gap in terms of that that mistrust or fear, whatever you want to call it. And I would think that the fact that you got 100 people to enroll suggests that that's true.
Yes, I would say that we learned a lot during this clinical trial. In the beginning, it was really slow going, but we worked really hard as a as a team at our company, and we worked really closely with clinicians and research coordinators and patient advocacy groups like the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research to get the word out, to educate people on the trial specifics, on all of the things that we did to make it easier to participate in the clinical trial. We had pretty loose requirements for participating in clinical trial. We wanted every potential patient who was not well controlled on currently available therapies in the study. We worked really hard to make sure that people understood that the drug had a history of safe use in other clinical trials so that people wouldn't feel like guinea pigs. We worked really closely with the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research, FSR, in order to reach as many patients just to let them know about the study. And then we, in a really white glove way, treated every potentially eligible and interested patient as a VIP and made sure that they were well served and well taken care of and well informed at every step along the way.
Yeah, Rainey, let's have you join this conversation a little bit. I mean, you really have to give that white glove treatment to people once they agree to do this, because they got to go out of their way. There's certain times that they have to take doctor's appointments and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that or thank the community in any way? I mean, what are you seeing from your perspective?
Absolutely. I think really the key for us was having those conversations with patients early on in the trial planning process and really listening to what was important to them and not assuming that some of these ideas that we had or services that we could offer were really what patients wanted, and spending time confirming that patients did, you know, what's appealing to them. A once monthly injection, you know, they don't want to come in as frequently, you know, they want to come in as infrequently as they possibly can within the boundaries of conducting a positive study. And they really need help in terms of, you know, the first initial assessment days are pretty long. So, you know, maybe we could get them a hotel the night before, they could come in the night before, being able to bring a family member, caregiver, a friend with them to these visits. And I think Bill touched on this earlier, but the most important thing that we have tried to do over the past 3 years is really just be very transparent with the patient community, not only talking about the benefits of participating in research and not only talking about what this successful completion of enrollment of this study could mean, but also being very honest about what the risks are and our understanding of, you know, of safety of namilumab based on previous studies, and really just being a resource for patients. I had so many questions over the last 2.5 years that I've been with Kinevant that facilitated me to push something out publicly on our study website or via FSR. We had a patient bill of rights to really reinforce who's looking out for patients through the process of participating in trials. Those are all direct questions that I was receiving over and over again. And we know that there's mistrust. We know that there's hesitancy. A lot of that is because no one is answering the questions that patients really have. And so we've just tried to go above and beyond as best we could to offer answers to what is important and what how patients can be well-informed and make a decision on whether or not they want to participate. And, you know, back to FSR, I think having FSR as a resource for patients as well, where one of the number one things we heard is patients don't know that clinical trial opportunities exist. That's mm-hmm. the first barrier is to say, well, I'd love to participate, but I'm not being seen at a academic medical center. And my community provider or community pulmonologist, they don't even know what Resolve Lung is. And I heard about it through FSR, or I heard about it through the sarcoidosis news group or another resource. And so really I'm very, very grateful for just how transparent patients were with us and allowed us to really learn what was important and be able to pivot and even make changes throughout the study to accommodate for the needs of this community and incredibly grateful for all of the patients that even considered participating. You know, we did successfully enroll 100 study participants, but there were countless others that considered participating or wanted to be seen at a trial site or sought out additional information. And I'm just so incredibly grateful for, on behalf of the entire team at Kinevant, grateful for just the community leaning in to something new and different and sometimes a little bit scary, and really offering us an ability to pull up a chair for them at the table.
Yeah, I think that's all great and well said. And one of the things towards the feeling of security, Bill, this data monitoring committee is out there watching in the background all the time. Can you tell people what that is and how that impacts, you know, what you do and what you're seeing, since this is a double blind type of research?
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. So just as a reminder, this is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled phase 2 study. And what that means is that all patients who volunteer for the study and are qualified are assigned to one of two different treatment arms, either placebo or namilumab, for 6 months. And nobody knows which arm that they are on. And an important feature of our study is that at the end of that 6 month period of time, all patients are eligible to participate in an open label extension, which means all patients will then have access to being on the investigational drug. So patients who enroll in this study know that at some point, either at the beginning or halfway through the study, they will have access to the drug and the potential to benefit from it. So during that double-blind phase of the study, of course, one of the things that all companies and all clinicians participating in clinical research are focused on is monitoring the safety and any potential side effects that occur from the drug. And sometimes that's hard to determine because patients, even on placebo, sometimes have symptoms that could be interpreted as side effects. And so because nobody knows which arm patients are on who are participating in the study, it's important to have a mechanism for being able to monitor whether or not the drug is creating any adverse significant risk to patients. And that mechanism is something called the Data Monitoring Committee, which is typically a group of clinicians with experience in the disease who are not associated with a clinical trial, who have access on a periodic basis to the data being produced in the trial. These are events that are being reported called adverse events, so nausea or diarrhea or any other symptom that a patient might be experiencing. They also look at assessments in the trial, pulmonary function and other assessments, and they look at blood samples that are being drawn on a regular basis to see if there are any changes in what are called analytes or markers of any, you know, effect that the drug might be having. And they look at the totality of the data, and if they have concerns, they will inform study participants, the sponsor, ultimately the clinical trial participant, the clinicians that are participating in the clinical trial, and say, hey, this is something that we're seeing and we need to bring it to your attention and we need to understand what it is and assess whatever the risk is to patients. And fortunately for this particular drug that we're developing in this clinical trial for these patients, we have a lot of history of the drug already being evaluated in clinical trials in more than 350 patients. And so far the drug has demonstrated a relatively safe and well-tolerated profile. And even in our own study, we've had several DMC meetings, data monitoring committee meetings, where they've looked at all the totality of data and they've given us the green light to proceed, which means that in combination with what we're seeing overall, that we are seeing a very similar safety and tolerability profile to what has been seen previously. And so that's been positive, because although we're not done with the clinical trial and other you know, issues could emerge during the clinical trial, we're hopeful that at the end of the day, we will have both a well-tolerated and an effective therapy for patients. Because if you survey patients, I don't know if your listeners will agree, but if you when we survey patients, the number one goal that they have for any new therapy is that it work at least as well as what's available now, but much more well-tolerated, doesn't have the side effects that these other drugs have. So they're not having to make the trade-off between the symptoms of the disease and the side effects of the drug in terms of how much, you know, of the medicine to take or to be on. So far, that's an opportunity that it looks like we're going to be able to, you know, realize.
That's good news. Rainey, anything you want to add there?
I'll just add one comment that I think is fairly well known. Preaching to the choir, as they say, talking with patients about medication and side effects, but it's really very important to remember that nearly 50% of sarcoidosis patients that require therapy, so those that have more severe forms of sarcoidosis, they experience what they call therapeutic failure. So they either are not receiving benefit from that medication, or they are just feeling, you know, the effects of toxicity of the drugs, you know, those extreme side effects, as Bill mentioned, that are sometimes even worse than the symptoms of sarcoidosis, or they can't tolerate the medication for another reason. And it's a really big statistic. You know, there's prednisone, and then there's off-label use of all sorts of other autoimmune.
Everything else.
And, you know, I think, John, you've talked about this on the podcast many times. It's, you know, even if the drug's not really working all that great, or the symptoms are pretty brutal, and, you know, a lot of folks will stay on medications because they had to fight their insurance companies for however long to even get access to try these off-label medications. And, you know, then to find out they're not really even all that, they're not helping all that much, or they're really not well tolerated. They come with a whole mess of other things to accommodate for on a daily basis. So, really, really hopeful that we can, you know, as an industry, there's so much interest in sarcoidosis now, and this big surge around new clinical trials and new drugs and just opportunities for patients to get involved in research. And with that should come this subsequent surge in information and knowledge and just transparency, sharing, you know, all that we know about what these benefits and risks are, and just really trying to push the field forward.
Yeah, I think we should point out, as of right now, there is no on-label drug anywhere that was developed specifically for sarcoidosis, right?
That's right. That's a big, as we say in the industry, a big unmet clinical need, is that you have a disease with a significant number of people who continue to suffer, have a poor quality of life, have a poor prognosis, despite what's currently available. And while clinicians can prescribe any drug that's approved and on the market for any disease, they don't know for sure which of those medicines are effective, because there have been no large scale clinical trials, and the FDA has not given their blessing, if you will, as to the effectiveness and safety of those drugs for treating a disease. So one of the opportunities here is to develop a drug that meets the FDA and other regulatory requirements for conclusively demonstrating safety and efficacy, which is a high bar, but an important objective to achieve, to be able to communicate to patients and doctors that this drug really works for these patients. But the second is, because once a drug is approved, then for that disease, insurance companies are, for the most part, required to reimburse for it. And the problem that patients have getting reimbursement, particularly for the biologics like Humira or Remicade, are related to the fact that those drugs have not been demonstrated clearly in clinical trials to be safe and effective for this disease, and they have not yet been approved by the FDA, and so therefore insurance companies don't have to reimburse for them, and that's the reason why clinicians and patients sometimes have to fight to get reimbursement. So we hope that we can not only develop a safe and well-tolerated and effective drug for sarcoidosis, but that also gaining FDA approval ultimately will make it much easier for patients to get access to the drug who need the drug.
Yeah, and that's why you're singing my song right there. I've had to fight, or my doctors have had to fight with, I take Humira. I talk about it all the time on the podcast. I have taken Remicade. We stopped that because of elevation in liver enzymes, which was starting to indicate maybe the long-term exposure wasn't the best for me. But it would be nice to know that there was a drug out there that you could walk in and the doctor would say, oh, okay, sure. Take namilumab or whatever you would call it if and when it reaches the level where it can just be prescribed, and the insurance company would have to pay for it. That, you know, from a patient perspective, I know that would be a very pleasing outcome. Let me ask you this: what is it about namilumab that works in the body? Like we're throwing this word around, which probably most listeners haven't heard of unless they've listened to the podcast, but it's not like it's an everyday word or everyday drug. How does it work? Why does it show such promise?
Yeah, that's a great question and important to understand in order to have enthusiasm for the clinical trials that are being done. So first, most all drugs act by acting on a molecule that's in the body. It could be a protein, could be an enzyme or hormone, a receptor on a cell, but all drugs work on what we call a target. It either inhibits the activity of that particular molecule in the body, or it activates it to a higher level. Bifurcation of what most drugs do, but obviously an oversimplification. In our case, we noticed that there was a key cytokine, a pro-inflammatory cytokine. In other words, a cytokine is a molecule that's produced by the immune system to regulate immunity and inflammation, and there are a lot of them in the body. But we noticed from studies that were being done that there was one cytokine called GM-CSF, which is an acronym for a hard to remember name, granulocyte macrophage colony stimulating factor, which is a long word to describe this cytokine. Other cytokines have simpler names like IL-4 or IL-5 or et cetera, but in this case, we noticed that GM-CSF was elevated in patients with sarcoidosis, and that the more severe the disease, the higher the levels. What that doesn't tell you are those high levels the cause or contributing to the disease, or is it just a result of the disease? So it's a correlation, but not a causation in and of itself. But then other studies showed an impact on actual granuloma formation. And as there probably nobody needs this reminder who's listening to this podcast, but granulomas are the hallmark of this disease. The accumulation in any organ system and the persistence of those granulomas and the body's inability to clear them naturally, which results in this chronic inflammation, which is an unsuccessful effort to clear, an attempt to clear those granulomas. That chronic inflammation leads to all kinds of symptoms that affect patients' lives. Eventually, it can lead to scarring, irreversible scarring of the organ, fibrosis, if you will, organ dysfunction, eventually, in some severe cases, organ failure. So it all starts with those granulomas. And if you can inhibit the formation and persistence of those granulomas, then you have a real potential to modify the underlying disease, as opposed to what is the case with most currently used therapies, which they're just trying to manage the inflammation that's related to the presence of those granulomas. So what we noticed in some studies being published was that in animal models, if this cytokine, if GM-CSF is missing, granulomas cannot form when challenged. And when GM-CSF is added back in, those granulomas form. So there was a good evidence that maybe GM-CSF is not just correlated with disease, but it's actually causing, it's actually an important driver of this granuloma formation and persistence. And then more recently, white blood cells there are a variety of white blood cells. Most of them are responsible for regulating the immune system. One particular white blood cells are called macrophages, and macrophages are known to be drivers of granuloma formation. And so in our own studies, what we're learning is that when GM-CSF is inhibited, that macrophage activity is significantly dampened, which leads to a reduction in granulomas. This is all outside of patients in animal models, in petri dishes, et cetera, which is the best we can do with the tools that we have. But all of that gave us conviction that maybe this drug has the potential to actually address the underlying underlying cause of this disease. And if we could successfully develop it, then if we could feasibly do a clinical trial, then we could potentially, accomplish something really cool, which is develop a wonderful new medicine that's well tolerated for patients. And so that's a little bit of the background behind namilumab target and what it's attempting to do. Namilumab itself is a fully human monoclonal antibody. An antibody is what the body kind of normally produces to fight infection, fight cancer, to regulate the immune system. And we have in industry gotten really, really good at making monoclonal antibodies. In other words, an antibody that is effective or targets just one protein in the body. And this is a biologic. It's similar to like a Remicade or a Humira, which is injected or infused. In our case, this drug has been formulated to be a once monthly sub-Q injection, which is very convenient from a patient standpoint. And it's got, as a category, a long history of doing amazing things for patients. Other monoclonal antibodies that have been developed for immune diseases, for cancer, and for other diseases, asthma, et cetera, have been phenomenally successful as a class at being very effective, therapies for patients. So this is not a new therapeutic modality. This is a tried and true therapeutic modality, and we're hopeful that we've got the right hypothesis for what is causing this disease and that we've got the right drug to make a significant difference in that sort of disease progression. We call it pathology, which is the pathway.
That is a great explanation. So basically we've got a drug that targets a single protein, a single molecule, and that is GM-CSF. And if it can do that successfully and safely without a lot of side effects, then maybe you can shut down the formulation of granulomas. Is there any reason, I know you're studying it in the lungs, but I think it's 90%, I've heard different numbers, but 90% of SARC patients have pulmonary involvement. Is there any reason to believe that it might also work for people who have other organ involvement? Theoretically, absolutely. I know we don't have any proof or any.
Absolutely. That's our hope, is that we can demonstrate its effectiveness in pulmonary sarcoidosis, which will give us a lot of confidence to eventually evaluate it for other forms of sarcoidosis as well, because fundamentally those same mechanisms are involved in causing sarcoidosis. The challenges of developing it for other forms of sarcoidosis relate to, sometimes those are different patient populations with different symptoms who, if the drug works, has a different measurement of efficacy than in pulmonary sarcoidosis. So it's likely, not necessarily, but likely that those different organs will require their own clinical trials eventually. But once a company like ours demonstrates proof of concept for treating one form of the disease, it's a pretty natural extension of the business model to then go and evaluate that drug for other forms of the disease with more confidence.
It seems to me like cardiac sarcoidosis patients are coming out of the woodwork right now in terms of the folks that are approaching me that want to be on the podcast or they're sharing their stories. That's completely anecdotal, but it just seems like there's a lot more cardiac sarcoidosis out there than I thought there was. Either that or those tend to be the severe cases, and that's what's rising up to the point somebody wants to talk about it. But so would that Absolutely. Require a whole new clinical trial? Would it still be off-label for cardiac sarc?
Well, when and if the drug is approved and on the market, doctors can prescribe this drug to whoever they want to for whatever they want to. That's one of the rules, one of the laws in the U.S. is that doctors can prescribe drugs off-label. The challenge is getting them reimbursed. So I think ultimately, even though this drug might get prescribed off-label for other forms of sarcoidosis once it's approved, the opportunity for conducting a clinical trial and conclusively demonstrating the efficacy of the drug in that particular patient population is important to drive adoption and for everybody to feel more confident and comfortable about prescribing it to those patients and to make it more easily reimbursed.
So Rainey, what happens next?
Very, very good question. So for the study participants that have recently joined, recently enrolled, the first 6 months is, as Bill mentioned, that initial trial period. So once monthly injections for 6 months of either namilumab or placebo, no one, the patients, the doctors, and no one at the study sites, us included, no one knows which arm you're on. From there, the open label extension. I also just to kind of put a pin in this for those that are not familiar with the term open label extension. Open label extension is fairly rare. It's not something that is a guarantee in clinical trial design, but it's something that, again, we really listened to what are the biggest fears or biggest concerns from the sarcoidosis community when considering a trial. And it's that risk of placebo. You know, I'm on something, it's not so great, but, you know, maybe it's helping me a little bit and I fought my insurance for it. Maybe I don't want to come off of it to consider placebo. And so ensuring that all study participants that complete that initial treatment period are offered access to study drug without having to apply for it, without having to, you know, make a case for it. It's an automatic rollover if patients are interested in that open label extension. So we have the initial treatment period for 6 months. We have that open label extension for 6 months, and tirelessly on the back end, patients are coming in once a month, and the clinical sites that we're working with, these centers of excellence all over the world, not just in the US, but also in all across Europe as well. The study teams are working with these patients to collect data, to make sure we're documenting everything per protocol. And our study team is also working diligently to make sure we have all of that information captured needed for that top line data by the end of the year. So if you're not familiar with the term top line data, really it's a high level summary of the important findings. It's not the full report of the study, but it's, you know, that initial confidence in whether or not we think the drug is safe and well tolerated, and also whether or not we think that it is going to work in this population, but ultimately helps us with a go or a no-go decision on a phase 3 study, which would really be that pivotal study, meaning applying for that FDA approval. So really exciting time.
So that now you're begging the question, assuming that by the end of 2024, everything goes according to plan with the rest of the phase 2 study, how many patients would you want to enroll in phase 3, and how long before you might run that study and potentially be looking at FDA approval?
It's a good question. Ultimately, it is a conversation with the FDA that determines the next study design and the number of patients that you would have to include and to enroll in order to satisfy their requirements for approval of the drug. But just broadly speaking, it took us a couple of years to conduct this study. It will take us a couple more years to conduct what will likely be a phase 3 study, assuming positive results from this study. And then there's about a year of preparation, a year and a half of preparation for the next study as well, too. This is a biologic, which is not simple to manufacture. And in order to support the next phase development, there is a pretty significant investment in scaling up the manufacturing so that not only can you supply the phase 3 study, but you supply the phase 3 study with exactly the same material, exactly the same drug formulation from exactly the same facility that you would commercialize and market and deliver the drug to patients once it's approved. So it's a pretty significant investment and a pretty significant preparation, which positive results from this current study would enable us to make happen.
So this is hundreds of millions of dollars we're talking about, right? To bring this all the way through?
That's right.
That's a big investment.
It's not for the faint of heart.
No, it's not. And I don't think people think about the manufacturing process. I think they just think there's a bunch of guys wearing white coats in a lab dripping something into a beaker. And if you can do it once, you can do it. You can always scale it, you know, and there'll be plenty of it to go around, right?
Yeah, no, it's a bit opaque and it's completely understandable. Nobody in my family understands it. They just, complain about how much, drugs cost. But being on this side of the table, it's a very, very complicated, highly regulated, very expensive industry and where failures rate is pretty high, and so I think there was a study done that showed if it takes 10, programs to generate one drug and you add up the cost of all those 10 programs that resulted in that one drug, that's over $1 billion invested on average to get any one drug, approved and on the market. So we, of course, hope that our drug in our clinical trial is successful and that the results are positive. And that will enable us to conduct the next phase of development, which includes manufacturing and clinical trial and a lot of other activities. But that would be an investment that we would be very pleased to make, given the potential to make a very significant difference in patients' lives who are suffering from this disease, not just from pulmonary sarcoidosis, as we discussed, but for all forms of sarcoidosis eventually.
If I could just, John, maybe add one other point, which is, of course, the goal is to develop a new therapy for the sarcoidosis community. That is, what we're all doing here. It's why patients have committed to helping us. It's why FSR is such a big advocate for research and support of research. And really, I think it's very critical to just remember that a lot of the foundation for future research is going to be built on the learnings of the studies that are being conducted today, regardless of whether these drugs work. So if you look across the 4 studies that are either actively enrolling or like ours that has, concluded enrollment or studies that are coming up and activating soon, all 4 studies have a different drug and all 4 studies have a different primary endpoint. And it says a lot about just the lack of previous research. And it also is a really exciting beacon of light and hope for the future, which is we're going to be able to utilize this data to better inform future research and to better classify what types of patients are at risk for the more severe or more chronic types of sarcoidosis or risk of flare in other organs, or, you kind of name it. You start asking, once you answer that first wave of questions, you start asking that next set and you build off that foundation of understanding in a disease that is wildly variable. Sarcoidosis is, as everyone listening to this podcast knows, Snowflake. Every single person has a slightly different experience, whether it's path to diagnosis, symptoms, organ involvement, response to treatment, whatever it is, it's so variable. The more we learn about these subsets of the population, you know, okay, Resolve Lung is looking at these types of patients. The EFZO-FIT study is looking at these types of patients and so on and so forth. We will just learn so incredibly much about how to treat or how to develop new drugs in the future or how to develop these drugs. And I just go back to how grateful we are for the patients that are interested and willing to partner with us. I think the strength and the perseverance of the sarcoidosis community is really incredibly powerful. And, completing enrollment of Resolve Lung not only proved that it's possible, right? It is possible to develop drugs for sarcoidosis, but, you know, I think it also just reemphasizes that their patients do believe there's a significant need for new therapies. Sometimes industry partners will say, well, we think there's a need, and whether or not there is, this could be a little bit, I don't know, somewhat of a gray area. Patients are clamoring for new treatments. They're invested, they're interested, they're asking the right questions, and ultimately we would not be here without them. And I just really want to extend a huge wave of gratitude that kind of at reaching this milestone is we as a collective community have reached this milestone, and the data will help us regardless. It's a good thing. It's a really good thing.
Yeah. Well, Bill, you want to wrap it up for us? I feel like you guys are really in a good place. Everything looks promising to the extent that you know or can reveal. The safety is there. The efficacy is being tested now. It will have been tested by the end of the year in 100 people in the United States and in Europe. And then if that goes the way you think, we got to get another a phase 3 trial going, and we're off. So what would you say to wrap this thing up?
Well, I think Rainey covered a lot of the important points here, but I always like to end with a call to action. And most of your listeners are patients, maybe caregivers, and maybe clinicians or research coordinators who are involved in this industry. And, you know, look, I think the fundamental premise that we all agree to is that everyone wants a better, better drugs for this disease, and eventually a cure. So that patients don't have to live with the symptoms of this disease, don't have to live in fear of the next flare, can resume their normal life without the side effects of currently available medicines. And the good news is that it's definitely achievable. There are a long list of diseases that have been conquered that were in the same place at one point in time as sarcoidosis. The industry is totally focused now on cracking the code for this disease, which is evident by the increase in clinical, research that is being done. But the only way to develop these new therapies is for all stakeholders to come together to make it happen. It takes a village. Yes, it takes researchers, scientists, people at universities, independent medical research institutes, or even at companies to better understand the mechanism of what causes sarcoidosis. It's probably multiple things that cause it, but until we fundamentally understand that, we're not going to conquer this disease. So their work is really important. Models that better predict response to a new or existing drug. Better yet, models that help us actually design a new drug that's going to have the best outcome, for this disease. And importantly, which patients would likely benefit from the drug. It's a heterogeneous disease, which means that there are all different kinds of patients who were called sarcoidosis. And you mentioned before the podcast that you had tried several different things that didn't work for you. You finally found one that worked for you. Other people have had the opposite experience. It's likely that there are subpopulations and that the disease needs to be segmented in order for patient A to be prescribed drug A and patient B to be prescribed drug B, and to understand in the beginning who would benefit from which drug instead of going through a trial and error. That would be huge, right, for patients. So all of that work is ongoing and needs to be successfully and doggedly pursued. Sponsors, pharmaceutical companies play a role in this village as well, too, to design and execute studies that are based on listening to patients and what their needs are and what concerns they have and what would enable them to better participate in and support clinical research. Providers, clinicians who treat these patients and are at these academic medical centers are hugely important. You'd asked earlier, what were the challenges to conducting clinical trials in pulmonary sarcoidosis? I would say, first and foremost, the number of clinicians who are both willing and able to participate in clinical research. John, this is going to surprise you, but we only had two clinical trial sites west of the Mississippi who were active participants in this clinical trial, even though there are a large number of patients in at least a dozen major cities west of the Mississippi, and there are dozens of academic medical centers, only two. In New York City, an SMSA of 11 million people, we had no clinical trial site that was willing or able to participate in a clinical trial for sarcoidosis. And that makes it really, really challenging for pharmaceutical companies to conduct research. So I would advocate strongly that those sites develop the capability and the interest to participate in clinical trials, and patients can support that by also advocating in their conversations with their clinicians, are there clinical trial opportunities? Do you participate in clinical trial research? If not, why not? Because clinicians to participate in order for patients to participate. We talk about patients participating, but if there are no doctors in their geographic area that participate in clinical trials, it makes it really, really hard. So I would put that on the list of things to make happen here. And then finally, patients, to participate if you can, and if you have access to consider participating. And not all clinical trials are, appropriate for all patients, and patients who want to participate in clinical research often can't because of the criteria, and the exclusion, and the need to sort of enroll a certain type of patient in order to maximize the probability. And it's frustrating for some patients who can't participate in clinical trials for those reasons, but they can still play a very important role, which is to promote the importance of participating in their support groups or in their patient advocacy, groups, or in the conversations that they have, with other patients, and to be, optimistic and supportive about the opportunity for making a difference. And so I would say that's how I would like to sort of end is, yes, we have a huge accomplishment, a very significant milestone in our journey to develop a new drug. Yes, this is important for the field in general. As Rainey mentioned, it's important for everybody to know that it's feasible to enroll these clinical trials, and we're proud to be able to demonstrate that. But also, there are things that the community can do as a whole in order to promote more clinical research that's going to be necessary to continue to develop new therapies for that work for all patients with all forms of sarcoidosis, so that ultimately we get to a cure that causes the disease to be a non-issue for people. And so, yeah, I just echo what Ace said. We're so very grateful for those doctors who did participate in the study, those research coordinators who are the unsung heroes often, because they do a lot of the heavy lifting at our clinical trial sites, and for their support. For the patient advocacy groups like the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research, we could not have enabled and we could not have enrolled this study without their support and advocacy and participation. And importantly, the patients who volunteer, they're the rock stars. And we're so grateful for that community and who all came together to help make this happen here, and that are helping to make things happen across the field of sarcoidosis and clinical research. Thanks for the opportunity, John.
Sure. I hope that the reach of this podcast is minimal, but people do listen in Europe, and we try
minimal but growing.
But growing, all the time growing, and we try to be the voice of sarcoidosis. So, Rainey and Bill, I want to thank you for joining me here on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, John.
It's an absolute honor, as always. Thank you.
I feel like a zombie, just feeding and stumbling.
All right, thanks to Bill and Rainey for joining me today. This is exciting news for the sarcoidosis community. And I just wanted you to know that I'm in semi-regular contact with Rainey in particular, and I'll keep you posted on any additional developments as the results of this phase 2 study become clearer and the company is cleared and ready to talk about it. And hopefully phase 3 testing begins. But all of this is good stuff so far, and I'm just really, really glad to be able to share it with you here on the podcast. So we'll have updates as soon as Kindevent is ready, and thanks again to Bill and Rainey. The official Sarcfighter song is Zombie by Mark Steyer and his band, the White Hot Lizards. You can hear Mark's story behind the lyrics in episode 12. He is a fellow Sarcfighter. The FSR Sarcfighter podcast is released every other Monday. As I'm speaking today, my trusty dog, Dougal, my boxer, is curled up in the chair in my office. Dougal makes my life so much better. The backstory to the founding of the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research is episode 11 with Andrea and Redding Wilson. They started this foundation over 20 years ago at their kitchen table. Don't forget to follow me on social media. Just search for Sarcfighter, Facebook, Instagram, Peloton. I've got a cycling blog, and boy, I tell you, I've been out riding my bike a lot. It's early May. The weather has switched. It is beautiful, and I have had some wonderful bike rides, and it just is, it is so good for my soul to get out on the bike. I was out riding on the Blue Ridge Parkway this past couple of nights. The dogwood trees have been in bloom, and spring has sprung in Virginia. It's absolutely beautiful. But I do have and I need to write something new, but I do have on my cycling blog, Carlin the Cyclist, I have a section called Cycling with Sarcoidosis. So you might want to check that out. Also, if you're new here and just trying to figure out what SARC is, go all the way back and listen to episode 2 with Dr. Simon Hart from the UK. My story is episode 1. If you want to reach out to me, the best way is via email, carlinagency@gmail.com. It is in the show notes with this podcast. And until next time, keep fighting.
Learn to suffer, you feel pain someday. Learn endurance, your strength will fade away. Dead man walking, trying to keep up the pace. Dead man walking, counting down.